Welcome to Awaken Calls. Every Saturday, we host a conversation with an individual whose inner journey inspires us and whose work is transforming our world in large and small ways. Awaken Calls are an all-volunteer-run offering of ServiceSpace, a global platform founded on the simple principle that by changing ourselves, we change the world to create a more compassionate and service-oriented society. Thank you for joining us.
Today, our moderator is Tapan Parekh, who is one of the early ServiceSpace volunteers, like really early ServiceSpace volunteers, and is currently the professor of information science at Cornell Tech in New York City. His research interests include human-computer interaction and the design and use of information technologies for supporting youth and community development. He currently leads the Milstein program at Cornell Tech, which bridges technological innovation with human interests through collaboration with humanities scholars and local arts and culture organizations. Well, this is like a formal introduction of Tapan, but if you ask his students, they always just say that, you know, he has a heart of service and contribution. Wherever Tapan, like whatever project he takes up, he really deeply connects with, you know, how can he be of service in that space, and really look at, you know, how can technology be combined with values, and how can that bring about a real shift in the way we live, in the way we are. So thank you so much, Tapan, and I would just love, like, you know, now you can take it on and introduce our speakers and drive the conversation forward. Welcome.
Thank you for overly generous introduction. I would say overly generous. I'm sure these two gentlemen would agree that it's overly generous introduction. But you know, I feel very honored today because it's a combination of several worlds that mean a lot to me. ServiceSpace, you know, I miss being on the West Coast because I think being able to connect virtually with ServiceSpace is one thing, but in the West Coast, where the of headquarters of the ServiceSpace ecosystem is, you know, I miss that connection. So it's really great to connect in this way with this community. But you know, the two gentlemen I have to introduce today, you know, that's a very different kind of relationship, I would say. You know, I think it's exactly 20 years. You know, it's exactly 20 years. It was, I think, September, October 2000, that I met both of these gentlemen. And, you know, I think to say that they had a transformative impact on my life is an understatement. You know, I think both of them had a profound impact on what I did with my life, with what I've done for the last 20 years. So it's to be here, you know, this many years later at this kind of time with this group, I think it means a lot to me. So I'm very honored and happy to be here. Now, you know, where to begin? Where to begin the story? You know, Professor Gupta was telling us in the informal session before how I approached him as a very, you know, I was a computer scientist. I am a computer scientist, in fact. And you know, I read a lot of Gandhi. You know, I read a lot. In fact, now I've read a lot of Marx. I've read so much. You know, I read a lot consistently even to now. But at that point, I was reading a lot of Gandhi, and I had gone to India and said, I have to connect in some way with Gandhi. So I end up at Gujarat Vidyapit. Of all places, I end up at Gujarat Vidyapit, teaching a computer science class and taking a Sanskrit class, you know, so it was a complicated situation. But in the middle of all this, Professor Gupta came to give a lecture. You know, my first week as a professor, really, in Gujarat Vidyapit. Professor Gupta comes to give a lecture, and he gives the lecture in Hindi. So, you know, my Hindi is not excellent, let's say, passable. So but what I saw in the lecture and the passion I saw in the lecture, you know, I just remarked that this is something I have to learn more about, you know. So I still, Professor Gupta was talking about the first time I visited him in Wing 13 of IIM Ahmedabad. You know, he was telling me this vision for a project, you know, that was so ambitious, you know, so visionary that I still don't think we've come close to realizing the kind of ambition that Professor Gupta had at that time. know, he wanted to make a network, a social network, you know, like the Facebook and like the Twitter, but not just about this political nonsense or this bragging to one another. You know, he wanted to make a social network that was really about innovation. You know, it was really about creativity, fundamentally, and creativity at the grassroots, that would really connect people from all over the world, whether they be in villages and small towns, you know, wherever they were, they could connect people, but really not connect people arbitrarily, connect people around their dreams, you know, connect people around their ambitions, connect people around the best versions of themselves. And I just thought that that vision and that ambition was so profound and so beautiful and so amazing that I had to serve it. You know, I had to find a way to support this. And there were a lot of, you know, then he explained to me all the technical difficulties. You know, this was in 2000, you know, these villages are connected by copper wire. Everyone is speaking different languages, literacy. You know, a lot of problems were there to try to realize this vision of connecting people around their ambitions and their dreams. And to realize this vision, we had Vijay Pratap Singh Aditya. Vijay Pratap Singh Aditya. So Professor Gupta said, you know, when he found out I was a computer scientist, he said, please, you know, you can join the team. You speak to Vijay. So then I had to find Vijay. And so late one night, I end up in the dorm of Wing 13. In the dorm of Wing 13, in the basement, this man is there. And first I reach there and he's not there. He has gone, you had gone to some meeting. You had gone to a meeting, but everyone, Vijay will return, Vijay will come. So next day I went, I found Vijay. So I still don't remember, Vijay was not as convinced by me as Professor Gupta was. Vijay said, we'll see what you can do, we'll see. And so since then, I think with Vijay, it's always been, we will see what you can do. And I admire that about Vijay also. You know, if Professor Gupta represents, you know, this ideal, this ambition, this vision, I think Vijay represents the reality of it, the reality of implementing such an idea in such a difficult operational landscape with such limitations, infrastructure, management capacity to make something happen in this context. Only someone like Vijay would even, you know, attempt it. And I would say since 20 years with Vijay has dragged me along, or I have dragged Vijay along one way or the other, but he has tried to implement this kind of vision for 20 years. So I think, you know, this combination of, you know, this vision, this ambition, this ideal, and the practical reality of it, I think we're uniquely blessed today to have these two gentlemen with us to talk to us about their experiences over so many years. So I feel really privileged to have spent some of my life working with these men. And I'm honored today to have this conversation with them about what we've learned and how we can apply it into this critical juncture in one would say in our societies, respectively, whether it be United States or India, we face critical junctures. So I wanted to just, you know, take a moment to recognize the journeys we've all been on together, but then also think about where we are, you know, where we are right now and how what we have learned helps us as we go forward. So maybe I'll just give Professor Gupta, Vijay, maybe I'll give you both 5 minutes if you want to introduce yourselves and give you some chance to explain, you know, what your take is on this, the story I've told you, and then we'll go into some deeper questions. So maybe Professor Gupta, if you wanna give your side of your introduction, and then we'll give Vijay one chance.
Well, let me first make it very clear that I'm here as someone who has been challenged by both of these young fellow friends. Vijay very brutally and harshly many times because he thought that I was not walking on the ground, but always in the air. He had made, I remember, a big chart after pasting papers on the full vision of what Honeybee Network would do, we still have to achieve that. So in that sense, I must say that there's a lot of unfinished agenda that we will talk about today. And to that extent, this talk, if it can bring more volunteers like Tapan and Vijay in our network, I would consider this time well spent, because there's so much to be done and so little has been done. I can brag, I can claim that I have walked in every state of the country, but then walking once in one state means nothing, actually speaking. The states, the diversity of India is so huge. But the satisfaction is that from Andaman to Goraj Valley, from Manipur and Meghalaya and Dhimaji in Assam to Rajasthan, Chamba and Lahul Spiti, having walked in all terrains through Shodhyatras, learning walks, we have been able to fathom through the length and breadth of our country how rich the knowledge and cultural diversity and cultural creativity is in our society, actually in every society. I have walked once, I proposed walking, but I had gone to a college in Maine, Colby College. And there was a professor there who said, we teach undergraduates and we have been, he was quite inspired by the Shodhyatras. He said, how would you do that in US? I said, let's find out some self-starters and let's take the students to them. So I like to mention this story because we went to a mushroom farmer, young, about 22, 23 year old mushroom farmer. So we took the students, went there by car, of course, and then were talking to him. So after a while, one student said, sir, you are telling us everything about mushroom cultivation. How do we get the spawn? How do we raise it? How do we package it? How do we commercialize it? You're telling us everything. So supposing I set up a mushroom farm, what will you do? And that entrepreneur said, I will supply spawn to you. In other words, I will move one ladder up, one orbit above. Then another student said, let's say I set up a spawn farm too, what will you do? He said, then I will get into medicinal mushroom, specialized mushrooms. In other words, he didn't see a competition at all. He was seeing cooperation. And out of his compassion, he was sharing everything openly. To me, without being a member of Honeybee Network, he represented the values of Honeybee Network, of cross-pollination, of sharing openly. All our databases are open, no password required. And we claim today that we have one of the largest databases in open access. Briefly mentioning, we have techpedia.in, which has 200,000 information of 200,000 engineering projects by 550,000 students of our country. Vijay may not know what he did in his final year, but I might find out. Or Tapan might not know, but I will be able to find out for all large number of colleges. I'm not saying 550 is a very small sample. 550,000 is a small sample compared to Indian size. Similarly, two students, I will just take one more minute to tell about this databases. So one more, two students, Devika Kaushal and Zygam Khan in my class in SMIPA, they were from IIM Nagpur. They were studying at IIM because the Nagpur Institute was being set up. They got a job afterwards and they said, Professor, we have time on weekend. What is one dream that you wish us to help you fulfill? And I said, look, I wrote a paper in 2003 about opportunity and expired patents. There are a lot of patents which are abundant by inventors. Can you help them, help us in pooling them? You know what they did? They created a database called as gyan.org/patent.php or techpedia.in/patent, which has 0.9 million abundant US patents. You can't find it in USA, but you can find from India. Any entrepreneur, any scholar, any researcher in US for that matter, or anywhere else in the world wants to access this open source knowledge of abundant patent, they can find it easily. Similarly, sarchi.org/WSA, database on medicinal plant, database on farmers practices, database on grassroots Indian language database guild. A lot of other such databases are open access because entrepreneurs like Vijay, professors like Tapan and all others who are today with us today might like to give their give such access to their students, their scholars, their partners, the communities with which they work, so that they can add value to what they know and go further. So I will stop here and say that openness is a very deeply rooted credential of our network. And I'm sure this is something that we all three of us share very deeply, that as far as possible, life should be open. Vijay might know that he had password to my all email accounts. Even today, all people who work with me have access to my email accounts. There's nothing confidential. And this openness, I'm not saying everyone should do that, but I'm just saying I do that because it helps in keeping life as accountable and as responsible as possible, because then all the warts and all the blemishes in our life get exposed and get and come under public scrutiny, scrutiny of your peers, so that you remain accountable to yourself and to your colleagues. Vijay.
Thank you, sir. So where do I begin? I think there was something very interesting I heard watching something on television recently. This was about the city where I was born, which was Kanpur in Uttar Pradesh state in India. For those who don't know, Uttar Pradesh is one of the largest states in India with a very large population and one of the most backward state also, needless to say. While I was born in Kanpur, I grew up in very, very small towns of Uttar Pradesh in different places. So my most psyche about the outer world comes from a very small town understanding of things. And since my parents come from villages, so village has been an integral part. All our summer vacations were in village because we couldn't afford anything else. So this was the beginning. So in this TV program which I was seeing, there was this small dialogue which was very interesting, and I found it very kind of reverberating in a sense, which will give you a insight into my perspective as well. Was that there are many cities in India which set claim to fame of the city of dreams, Mumbai or Bombay being one of them, has been always the city of dreams, and now Bangalore and Delhi and many other cities. There's one city in India where dreams are broken, and that is Kanpur. Now, for those who don't know, Kanpur was considered a Manchester of East at one point in time, one of the most industrialized city in the country. And today it is completely in ruins, like the state and much of the country is. Largely it represents the chaos or the disappointments and what Tapan was saying, that let's see what he can do. So that attitude comes, that idea comes, that because you have been promised so many times of something which will come, is that you become suspicious of everything that is being offered to you. So I come with this, mindset of not so positive, but add to that is the something which kind of you imbibe as a learning over a period of time. And I thank Professor Gupta for that. Also, when I landed up with Professor Gupta looking for a job in something that I wanted to do, I'm not sure whether I've told Professor Gupta that I, in my campus placement of the three job offers that I got, you paid the least. I still joined there and never regretted a single day for that. So the reason what gave insight is the like Tapan said initially when he was describing the vision, I still remember walking into his office. So I was supposed to, coming from Bhopal for an interview with him, I was supposed to kind of land up and go to a guest house where somebody I will wash and, go to a toilet or something, but nothing of that sort. Professor Gupta directly called me in my sandals and not even combed hair into his office and said, your interview starts now because I don't have the time. So that is how my interview started. And he said that, you know, what I want to do, I want to make a periodic table of innovations. And then he started describing what that means. And I know everything, I won't bore the audience with that details. But that, like I said, is a work remaining incomplete of professor's vision and many other things I must add. That is something opened up a world of possibilities to what I think what I'm doing right now, or trying to do right now, is that limitations, meeting hundreds of those innovators, walking in Shodhyatras, and meeting many, many people who do wonderful thing in adversity, and walking or traveling across the country, exposed to that wonderful diversity which we have. And within that diversity, the deep-seated resilience that communities or people have, fills you with a deep sense of respect for population as such. And then kind of pushes you on a corner to say that, what are you doing? You are a privileged person. You talk about, I don't have this and I don't have that. What are you able to give? So which is kind of a challenge. That can you use your intellect or knowledge or whatever learning you have to do that can bring about a change? And I think that's what the change journey is, something which we started 20 years back, continues with ideas. The core value remains the same. It has never changed even once. But how we work on it over a period of time is going on. So this is in short, Tapan, what?
Yeah, I think, thank you for that. Thank you for both of you for this reflection. You know, I walked down memory lane, you know, many, many years of ideas, collaboration. I mean, what always inspired me, you know, about Professor Gupta's vision of service was that it was never about, you know, weakness. It was never about charity. You know, it was about recognizing the uniqueness and the creativity and the brilliance that's in every human being. Every human being has the potential to be brilliant. And that was, I think, what was beautiful about this vision. You know, it was not a recognition of someone's need, but it was a recognition of everybody's potential and everybody's creativity. And so just the joy I remember when we went on Shodhyatra, you know, of the farmers that were invited to be recognized, they may not even have known why they were called there. Some of them may not have known. But when they were called there and when they were recognized and what they were told, what they were being recognized for, just the shock on their face that I can be recognized for my knowledge, I can be recognized for my creativity. That to me is the most fullest realization of what one might say is socialism or revolution or any of these amazing words. To me, that's a revolution within every human being, that they can be something more than what they are. So I always thought that was very inspiring. It was a very inspiring vision. But I also agree with Vijay, you know, that let's see, you know, so when you bring that to the ground, I think the people's level of skepticism, of apathy, of disappointment, is at sometimes so high that how do you maintain this kind of optimism? How do you maintain this kind of will when it seems like all of the institutions and the formal institutions and all of the experts are off on so many wrong tracks? How do you maintain this kind of optimism? Maybe I'll start with Vijay. You know, how do you maintain the optimism and the will in the face of this kind of world that we live in?
Difficult question.
The difficult question for Vijay, but I'm sure he will answer it. He began by introducing himself as a skeptic and but yes, Yegon is a very optimistic model, so I'm sure he has some source of optimism somewhere.
So I don't think I would say myself as a skeptic. Skeptic. Thank you for correcting me yet again, Professor. So I won't say. I come with that realization a little bit on what is wrong. So getting to know why it is wrong is something which gives you an optimism, because sometimes you don't know what is wrong and what and how and why it is wrong. And it takes time to realize that it is so simple. Sometimes the problem is so simple that and it looks outwardly very complicated. And I think this is something which I learned over a period of time, that I think what is missing piece always is that is an ecosystem which allow people to channelize the best of themselves. Let me give an example, what change can bring about and how it can bring about, is that in recent time, during Corona period, you might have heard that huge problems happened because supply chain was disrupted overnight without any forewarning and anything. So 1.3 billion people were told that you will not get anything from tomorrow. And that is what it happened. Such a large scale disruption requires planning, which wasn't there. And then just imagine that people left to their choices, how will they find a way out of it? That is something remarkable in a sense, which is remarkable, that what to do and how to do and how to go about it. So if there are institutions which work, and let me give two examples to illustrate a formal institution and informal institution. So we have in India, we have these large network of kirana stores, we call them small shops, neighborhood shops, millions of them are there across the country, run by families who employ 2-3 people, and these stores. These are supplied largely by local farmers. And most of those farmers are small and marginal. If you look into, if a large scale disruption of supply chain happens, it happens in China or US, there are systems to take over. And there aren't any systems here. But still, the 1.3 billion people got food. We were worried, many of us were worried that there would be food crisis in the country because of disruption, but there wasn't. And it wasn't because of these small supply chains. And this is what I think is a very, even our formal economy, whatever we call it, a formal economy, we always claim that's a very large part of what India is. I disagree with it completely. And I say that's a very small part of it. What we see is only a very small part of it. Largely, it is completely this small institution which work. And that is what made it work. Let me give the example of a formal institution, which is the Amul company, the Gujarat Cooperative Milk Federation, which is a formal institution of millions of small milk producers, the only of its kind in the world. These are very small farmers coming together. And imagine that government of India, the big government of India, we call that, provided about 25,000 crore rupees of direct aid to the farmers of the country in the form of help. Whereas one small company in a big world of India provided 4,500 crore rupees of aid to its own farmers who are supplying milk to them. Now, that's a big testament of something which an institutional innovation or an institutional system do. And that is something which I actually believe is that a missing thing has been this institution which is community owned and the community accountable to the community. And if it can be made to work or if it can be created, in some way, and technology, knowledge systems, information, innovation, all of them come together to help it in this ecosystem of learning. I think that that is what gives you, at least it gives me hope that something is achievable. And it's not very difficult because we have examples of them.
Thanks, Vijay. Professor Gupta, did you want to add something?
Well, I would say that it is true that small supply chains worked, but as always, there is always an opportunity for innovation, even in this space of stress and crisis. So we were trying to feed through Gyan and Srishti. Kishore, one of our colleagues in Gyan, was coordinating this activity, and Anamika, CEO of Gyan, was helping in managing it, that there were a lot of migrants who were stuck. So about 700 of them were stuck behind an institution, Nirma, in Ahmedabad, who could not go back to home and who had no work. So they had problems of food. Government was trying to provide food sometime, somewhere, and there were people who got coming to check whether we were genuinely trying to do that, but we were using some resources from our friends, some of our own resources. And we designed a program called as Annapurna. So I went there twice, though with police permission, that look, what we are giving is something very ordinary. If we don't give it, somebody else will give it. If we don't provide it to you, you can find it from elsewhere. Food is not that unique that we are contributing. But we want something in return. We don't want you to feel that you are being obliged. So we have a demand and we want to make it reciprocal. So will you share your knowledge with us? So Food for Knowledge program we started. They will share their knowledge. We gave them notebooks, pen, and they could also tell us on the phone, so we will record it. And we will provide the food. That was the deal. First they said, what knowledge do we have? And I said, no. And then I gave one example. In a meeting, we were standing under a tree with normal distance being maintained. And I said, there was a whitewash going on in my house and a whitewash worker cut his hand. He went out and came back and the blood had stopped. So I asked him, what did you do? He said, sir, there was some spider's web on the wall, cobwebs, and I had cleaned them just a little while ago. So I went and put that web, that spider's web, on my cut, and immediately the blood stopped. Now, those of you who are skeptic about it, go to web search, Yahoo or Google, whichever search engine you prefer, and write down spider's web blood coagulation, and you will find this is one of the fastest, efficient, most blood coagulant. Now, this person whitewashing my wall is able to provide me knowledge which is on the edge of technology, which only few people in the world have done experiments on. Even though there are not too many commercial products at the moment, we in Srishti had made a cell line because we didn't want to kill spiders for extracting this biochemical from body. So this example triggered their mind. They said, you see the tree behind you? I said, yes. You know, we take the leaves of this tree and then something else and mix them together for piles. It is a very good solution. And once one person started, other people started unlocking their mind and knowledge started flowing. It happened in Kashmir. We tried the same model in Kashmir because we were trying to provide food in Anantnag. Sabzar and Nadeem and some other friends were helping us. We tried in Madurai with Vivekanand. And in most places, it worked. So there was a dignity. We felt obliged now because we got something more precious than what we gave. And this is the crux, actually. The service space must always keep in mind that what we give is always less value than what we get in the process. So my grandfather once told me, he was a monk. He said, whenever you do an inch of favor to anybody, treat it as a mile. You will remain, whenever anybody does a favor to you, treat it even an inch of favor, you treat it as a mile. You will remain under debt. You will never be able to pay it back because you are taking it as a mile of favor to you. And life will become very joyful. And I followed this advice that what we gave was an inch of thing. What they gave was a huge value. So we were under great, genuinely under great debt, because that knowledge was not accessible by any other means. We couldn't have got. There were people from West Bengal. There were people from Jharkhand. There were people from different Bihar. There were people from different parts of the country. How would we go to all those places to access this knowledge? Here was an opportunity for us to access this knowledge. We tried to persuade many other groups to follow this model, but somehow it did not diffuse as much as I had expected. Somehow people find much greater joy in giving than in receiving, though they get joy. I mean, they get gratefulness, they get satisfaction. That is a great joy. But I think we can make it even more richer. The exchange can be more richer, that every recipient of any small favor from you can actually make a big obligation on us by providing much larger, much more precious knowledge. How valuable this knowledge is, let me give an example and then I'll come back to you. Do you know that flaxseed today is consumed by people, vegetarians particularly, as a source of omega-3 fatty acid? I'm sure, Vijay, you sell this also on Eggow. It was fed to horses. It was 100 rupees a quintal. Today you sell it 100 gram for 100 rupees. You see the point? Nothing has been done to the seed. Only knowledge has been added. Characterization of flaxseed as a source of 3 omega fatty acid, an important nutrient for vegetarians who don't get it from the food as much, made it so precious. There are large number of products, crops, the weeds, so-called edible weeds, other things produced by or conserved by or processed by the poor people, which are very rich. In fact, the food of the poor is very rich. That's why they won't be able to do hard work that they do. How will they do so much manual work if they didn't get that nutrition? So I would say that the knowledge, the rich, economically poor people that we have always tried to connect in Honeybee Network are indeed knowledge rich. And I'll never get tired of telling examples of that. And I think, Vijay, this is an opportunity of providing more knowledge along with the product. Every product that you provide, if it has more references on scientific knowledge, there are, you know what happens today? People go, when they get medicine from the doctor, they don't even trust that fully. They go and search on the Google what medicines are for. Today, people have become so conscious of more information that they need for the product. And I think the time has come to add value by providing knowledge. And sometimes you can say, this community has given us this knowledge, and this is the scientific evidence of this knowledge. In many cases, you will find evidence. And only take those claims for which you have evidence, so that it is science-based. But, and though this is not anecdotal, it is not hearsay. And science-based evidence of the validation of the knowledge. But there will be some knowledge of which there may not be validation, in which case we will say, as reported by community, we have no evidence, but it is reported and we are sharing this in good faith, so long as it doesn't have any ethical issue. So I would say that what Vijay has mentioned is very critical, that even in the times of crisis, we also got another dimension of human society. There were people, as it happened in the plague during Surat, people also became suspicious. Just as there were neighbors, people who were helping their neighbors, particularly elderly people, who couldn't go to market to get their provision, and they were vulnerable people anyway. There were also people who were trying to keep away from anybody who had infection so that they suffered. So there were both kinds of things happening. The good and the bad part of human nature was getting expressed. But I think there was more good part that was getting expressed. When you saw those images of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people walking, it still is a painful reminder to us. It will remain as a blot on human civilizational memory for a long time to come. And sometimes we were trying to reprimand them for being on the road when they couldn't have done anything. I mean, what could they do? I mean, some people wanted to die near their parents, their home. They said, if we have to die, let us die near our home rather than in a strange place. So there was that. But then there were people, I saw some Sikhs, devotee as they always are of service orientation, bandaging the feet of the migrants. I mean, there were such scenes where people were bandaging the the boils on the feet of the migrant who are walking for hundreds of miles. So they said, we can't alleviate your suffering, but we can reduce it. So there was that sense, and that quality of human society, as Vijay rightly mentioned, came out in an unequivocal sense, not just in India. I think in most parts of the developing world, their supply chains were disrupted. I think the society could survive because of solidarity, because of compassion, because of collaboration, and sometimes because of creativity.
Tapan, can I add or take it from what Professor was saying? Two things, and thanks for that. What Professor Gupta said, I'll build upon those two things. About 80 million people started walking home, unparalleled in the history of the world, that such a large population started migrating from what is called as the city, the formal habitation, to what is called the village, which is not considered, which is considered largely as inhospitable or lacks infrastructures or lacks medical facilities. People leaving the security of the good medical infrastructure to the security of food that they will get. And except for this, just imagine that this 80 million people walking back, the government system wasn't even there to help them. It wasn't there. It came later, much, much later, a little bit after abstractions and all kinds of things. It was the people themselves who were seeing these people walk, came forward and offered help, like what Professor Gupta was giving one example. But imagine this, such a large population and number of people who died of hunger while walking such a long distance were very few. They didn't die of hunger. They died of road accidents and other things, but they didn't die of hunger. They didn't die of somebody trying to loot them on the way back, whereas criminals are there. People were helping out, coming out and helping each other. And this is the power of the community which holds that. Coming to one particular example Professor Gupta was giving on valuing your knowledge and traditional knowledge and wisdom, I think flaxseed is one fantastic example. Flaxseed and similar other oil seeds. There's a seed called Ramtila, which is called Niger. These are oil seeds which have been traditionally growing for thousands of years. One of the areas where we work in Madhya Pradesh, Madhya Pradesh is the largest producer of flaxseed in the country, India. Flaxseed has been grown for thousands of years. Tribal farmers have been growing it for thousands of years, and that's rightly mentioned by Professor Gupta, because they use this, because they are used to a life of hard labor. Flaxseed adds to the strength, body strength. But what happened? What happens when a formal system interacts with this tribal system of knowledge and creates a dissonance in it? Let me give one example. Today, most of the tribal, India has the largest number of malnourished population in the world. We are number one, right? And also hungry people in the world. And most of these people are the same tribal people. When the informal state was there, tribal people were largely self-sufficient. They were okay to rely, their health was better, right? They might not have a better education system or other social needs, but they physically were much better in shape. But today, with the coming of the formal system, it is other way around. People started eating white rice. White rice was never culturally part of the diet of a tribal population, never. In rural population also, white rice was never a part of the diet. But that has been, so millets have been supplemented, which is now a rage in consumer market, urban consumer market. Millets have become a rage. Millets was a staple diet for most of these tribal families, because these grain is a very sturdy grain, can be stored for a very long time. And that is why that was grown. So this knowledge and wisdom, and these also understand that most of these grains are very sturdy climatically also. They are climate resilient crops. They are both climate resilient crop. They use less water and they can be stored for a longer period. And they are better in nutrition than any other grain which is available. Now, these have been replaced by the formal system, which said, eat white rice. And white rice became a status symbol. So most people supplemented this white rice as a status symbol, not because anything else. Of course, it was available cheap. That's another thing. But the point is, whenever formal system interacts with a traditional wisdom and knowledge, it is, has this exploitative relationship of taking away things. We know the origins of the drugs for malaria. We know the origins of many such drugs which have been taken from traditional families and exploited for commercial purpose. But the point again is that who is the trusteeship? Where is the trusteeship of this knowledge lies? Who is the holder of this knowledge? And unfortunately, what we are seeing right now, although that a lot remains, is that the formal system, whenever it comes into a traditional society or a traditional system, has always tried to exploit that system for its own gain, never giving back anything into that. And this is where I say is that all our so-called knowledge that we have built from our management education, our management institutions are very poorly managed. That is itself is a travesty because they don't give right ethical values and ethical and moral values to be imbibed in the business practices that are supposed to be there. And this is something which I believe is that only possible when ownership structures, which in these ecosystems of knowledge and production systems and market systems have some component of the primary producer in it. And that is most important point. None of these knowledge systems will survive or will benefit the people who have upheld this knowledge system for a very long time until unless the trusteeship is transferred back to them.
Thanks for those great reflections. I think, you know, that's a very interesting potential set of tensions, you know? So I think on one hand, you know, you talk about this distinction between formal and informal systems, you know, and you know, the example of, you know, we could talk about the example of giving ownership to producers, but then if it's formal, won't it fall into the same traps of that it could be with any kind of formal system? Let me give you just one example of, I think we're living in an era where there's a lot of skepticism about formal, expert-based, top-down kinds of systems. And, you know, the pandemic is one excellent example. You know, I live in New York City, maybe one of the most poorly managed places in the world in terms of the COVID pandemic. And I was waiting for a subway the other day, and there's a completely informal system. No one is telling anybody which subway to go into, whether to wear a mask or not. Everyone has to decide on their own. And who's riding the subway is mostly low-income people, mostly minorities. You know, so a whole people are there, and the subway is starting to become more crowded because people are going to work. Now, people know that the rates are going up. And so I was there on the platform the other day with my two kids. And there was a lot of people waiting. And I told my kids, I said, we'll wait for the next train. So the first train came, only a few people got on because they saw that it was already full. 2 minutes later, the next train comes, the remaining people get on that train. Now, this was completely informal. There was no supervisor, there was no manager, there was no delegation, no responsibility, just a set of people decided on their own that we should wait for the next train because that makes sense based on what we know. Now, let me contrast that to a formal system. Today, I went for the COVID testing. One of my children had to go for the testing because they had been exposed in some way. So they went through the formal system. Now, the formal system is organized through a bureaucratic process in which the children had to wait for 1 hour in an enclosed, unventilated room with other people who had been exposed before they could be tested. Now, no one would design this kind of system. It doesn't make any sense. You're exposing people to one another. Now, the point I want to make is that in this era where we are seeing expert systems fail so badly, formal systems fail so badly, in both of our countries, in fact, in India and the USA. So, How can you even say that the formal system is providing any value? Is it providing any value? Is there any value in interacting with the system at all? Should these people just not carry on the way they're doing and what they have always done? What is there any benefit interacting with the formal system? Maybe Professor Gupta, I'll give that one to you.
I think you both of you are being very harsh. Having dealt with both the systems unequivocally, the very purpose of Honeybee Network was to build a bridge between formal and informal science and technology. So this is the question was which was at the heart of 33 years ago, at the heart of the genesis of Honeybee Network. And despite all my complaints about how formal system has not contributed as much as it should, let me give you some positive news. So three organizations that we set up, Srashti in 93, Gyan in 97, NIF in 2000, I have stepped down from NIF's executive responsibilities in 2018 now. And all the three witnessed a huge contribution by the formal system. For example, every year when we gave awards at the hand of Dr. Kalam and then Mrs. Patil and then Sri Pranam Mukherjee and then Sri Ramnath Kovindji, the four presidents with whom I worked very closely, four presidents of our country, India. Since presidents were giving the awards, the validation was very important for these claims because tomorrow anybody can question as to what ground did you give recognition to somebody, a tribal or a farmer or an artisan or a mechanic. And can you believe that not one scientist charged for his time or her time. They all contributed. The validation support without charging for it. Whether from CSIR, Council of Scientific Industrial Research, whether from Indian Council of Agriculture Research, whether from Indian Council of Medical Research and Department of Biotechnology, not one charged a penny to us for their time. Yes, and in many cases, they did not even charge for consumables. They said, we have our project, we can do it. We have a student, they will do that for you. Don't worry. So our cost of validation was about 3 to 4 lakhs on average, which otherwise would have been 20 to 25 lakhs per case. Take another case, intellectual property right. And I will mention here why, how we have hybridized the Western and Indian model. So we were filing patents for people. We have filed patents in USP, United States also. In 2003, three innovators, not even educated beyond 10th class, got patent in US. And our friend, Tom Turano, who was at that time in THT and later on was senior partner in KLNG, Galen Gates, company law company in Boston. And there are a large number of patent firms in India, Anand and Anand, Surana and Surana, global business, so many of them. Not one of them charged for their time. All the help. Our average cost was 15,000 rupees. Less than $200, as against $2,000 it should be. And in US it should be $10,000. How could we do that? Because people believed that when benefits were going to the people from the informal sector, the most creative people that we could discover through our with limited means and limited resources and limited network, the volunteers of Honeybee Network went from place to place to look for such creative people, and we wanted to protect. And what did we do in the model? We said, people-to-people copying is allowed and encouraged. People-to-firm through licensing. We hybridized, we created a technology commons model that for common people, patents will never be enforced. We have not enforced ever any patent against a fellow farmer, fellow artisan, fellow mechanic. So in other words, we can design institutions that can get support from the best, from the formal system and make it available to common people of our society at terms that are compatible with the culture and the spirit of sharing, of generosity, of, I mean, how have our society survived? By sharing knowledge with each other. Do we want to stop that culture? No, we don't want to. Do we want to erode that culture? No, we don't want to. We want to reinforce that culture, and we did. So what I'm trying to say is that it is possible to invent institutions or modify them or graft new values over the existing institutions, with all their limitations, of course, to create new models of openness, new model of sharing, new model of reciprocity, new models of responsibility, new models of trust. But please remember that while doing this, there will be challenges. There will be people, some firms will take benefit of some innovations and not give due credit. Those cases will happen. But I must say that people who contribute positively are far more than people who shortchange the system and take advantage of it. So yes, in the past, Vijay is right that there has been a lot of exploitation. I will not deny that. It is fact. There's a beautiful book. There are two books I want to show you. One is American Givers. And this American Giver is about what indigenous people of America gave to modern America. This is a book that one you should read if you have not read it. Beautiful book, very old, but very book. I think it came out in '80s, early '80s. The second book that I want to show you, I don't know if I can share the screen, is this book. Fortune in Formulas for Home, Farm, and Workshop. I have a 1901, 1902, first time, and it has continued to be published. I have 1939 or 1942 version of this. And this book by Gardner, O'Connor Sloan, they have edited it. And now what does this book have? This book has information collected from the people. Unfortunately, they have not acknowledged those people. That's the unfortunate part. Just as ethnobotanists and ethnozoologists for such a long time have usurped the intellectual property of the local communities. So there are disciplines which celebrate exploitation. I agree with Vijay. And ethnobotany is a good example. And ethnozoology is a good example. They go document the knowledge of tribal and become the author of that knowledge. Just imagine in this meeting, somebody was taking notes of what we're discussing and publishes an article as an author of those notes. That is what ethnobotanists have done for all these years, with due respect to them. All these years. So this is the limitation, but the advantage is that it gives us insight that even in USA and Canada, people were documenting very carefully how local communities, even settlers, immigrants, and indigenous people were solving their problems. So for example, one of the practices in this book of Fortune in Formula for Farms, Farms, and Workshops is soap made out of the fat of different fishes, when dissolved in water and sprayed on crop, helps in controlling different pests. Can you imagine the connections? The fat in the fish, different kinds of fat in different kinds of fish, used for making soaps of different kinds, and spraying soap solution, which is a practice even done today in our country by the farmers. And then this soap solution is sprayed to control the pest. Now, this is a great connection that human mind can make without access to formal scientific labs and research. So when it comes to knowledge system, I'll give you one more example. There's one Department of Agriculture in Manitoba, Ontario, Canada, 2005. Vijay will recall that in Honeybee, we had published an article on use of milk for viral disease control by Dr. Chari, long time ago, a review article. Because he shared once an practice of how tobacco farmers put their hand in a pot of milk while transplanting seedling so that the spores, tobacco mosaic virus, would not spread. In Manitoba, they have given an advisory, formal system has given advice, the only advisory that I have come across so far in the world, unfortunately. I don't know why more departments of agriculture and extension are not, or livestock are not doing that, but that's a limitation. So Vijay is right that formal system is not yet fully on board. That I agree. But in some places, they are creating examples. So they have an advice that using milk for cleaning your tools in the garden or washing your hands or treating seeds to prevent the spread of viral disease is as effective as anything else. And they mention about the chemical that you can use. And they also mention that milk is as effective as. Actually, they're acknowledging that. In 2005, they acknowledged that. So what I'm saying is, yes, a great revolution waiting to be enacted in our world, where we would democratize knowledge through proper blend of formal and informal systems so that the people who produce this knowledge benefit. That is the responsibility, Vijay, on you, people like you who are connecting the markets, the informal and the formal market. I mean, you have to ensure that people whose knowledge made that product Niger or other millets profitable, and I know that you're doing that. You're getting benefits in the hand of producers of this crop and not in, traders of this crop. So therefore, the benefits are going directly to the community. That is an evidence of what you're trying to do, of getting money from our pocket and delivering it to the pockets of the tribal, which otherwise, without platforms like yours, probably like Egon, would have been very difficult to do. So I think the fair trade is the name of the game where ethical practices can indeed be brought into. Let us not be too cynical, Vijay, about the prospects of management institutions bringing about responsibility, because I have taught in a management school for 36 years. And I must say that with all the limitations, you know how many offices I had, how much space I had in IMA, more than any professor anywhere in the world would have had as many offices I had, which you've seen those offices. I think that tolerance and that encouragement that the Institute gave to the Honeybee Network was exemplary in many ways. And why don't we take this example that maybe other institutions should do the same thing? They should also encourage, Cornell should encourage, Berkeley should encourage, Boston University should encourage, Harvard should encourage, MIT should encourage the work where four things will happen. Four basic principles that are now appealing to everybody who is watching this program to remember these four principles. Number one, whenever you learn anything from people, acknowledge it. Sometimes people are producers of knowledge, sometimes they are communicators of knowledge, but for you, they are a source of knowledge. So at least as a communicator, as a provider, knowledge provider, they should be acknowledged. Number two, whatever you learn from them should go back to them in local language. That's why we have different language versions of Honeybee newsletter. We would wish to have more, and we will wish all our databases to be in multiple languages. We can't afford it today, but I'm sure with volunteers, we'll be able to do that in due course. So it must go back to people in their local language. Third, whatever you collect from other people should also go back to them. So let's say somebody gave a practice about ergot in millet, in bajra, in penicillium, and typhoids. Then pick up other practices of ergot and share them. Tell them that in Brazil, in Latin America, people make fermented food out of the affected ears of bajra. They make a food out of it. In India, there is no practice, but Latin America, there is. That knowledge from Latin America needs to come to Indian farmers so that they don't throw away those ears, but they can make food out of them. Third thing, fourth thing, that if we develop any value addition, any consultancy, any per diem, any money out of this process, a reasonable share of that should go back to people. These are the four principles by which Vijay, the call for trusteeship that you're saying, and rightly you're saying, that is what Gandhiji said, that we are trustees of people's knowledge and we must responsibly discharge our trusteeship responsibility. Our ethics should be very clear that through these four processes that Honeybee Network strongly believes in. But I must acknowledge the National Science Foundation of US, you know what it says? It says, make people anonymous. The rule should be, acknowledge the people unless otherwise requested. That should be the norm. So Tepan, you should write to the NSF. You should write to the NSF tomorrow, Monday, first thing, that look, in your policies for researchers funded by you, it is mentioned categorically that the people should be anonymity of their source of knowledge should be maintained. No, the rule should be acknowledge. Anonymity is exceptional if the people claim so. So there is a lot of reform required in the institutions of excellence around the world, including in USA and our own UGC, University Grants Commission, or AICTE for that matter. There's a need for reform. I agree with you. In the same institute where I taught, when you write a case on a company, you have to clear it with the company. Before that, you can't use it in the class. But when you collect knowledge from the people, sometimes it is not required that you get the signature from the local chief, village council, or somebody that you have authorized access to this knowledge. So you are right that there is a need for parity to be brought in our responsibility toward knowledge provider in formal and informal system. But this is a task that all of us have to work towards. This dialogue that we are having today, hopefully, will nudge Tapan to pursue this matter. He is a great advocate. He believes strongly in certain things and he advocates them very strongly. He uses strong language. I've seen his tweets. He uses very strong language on the island issues and so many other issues. But please direct your energy not at island level, but direct that energy at NSF level. Bring about change in the big institutions of the society, because there are not too many Tapans we have, not too many Vijays we have. You understand? My time is over. You have to take the cudgels on behalf of these people and nudge the institutions. Have faith that there are good institutions and somebody will listen to you and somebody will help you to take this idea forward. And there will be a day when all the four principles will be the way business is done in this world.
What do you think, Vijay?
So Professor, as always, has been very generous to the formal institutions, which I am not. Because I can't, like I said earlier, I can't ignore the incompetency of the institution, formal institutions, in being able to solve the problems that they are. been. Professor's institution itself, the management institution, considered still itself to be a premier of agriculture economy. India's agriculture economy is so poorly managed that a person who has been able to understand it will say that it is being managed by kids. So this is, so I have to be harsh because, you know, I can see that it is. Formally, and I have argued about this with many, many people, is that the formally Indian agriculture economy is said as at around 14% or 16% of GDP. But I dispute this claim, even by many economists, that it is not. India's agriculture economy should be upward of 30% of the GDP, because you can see right now that the entire production sector, services sector is under, has collapsed. Whereas why the country is working? The country is working because there's a very powerful food economy. There's a very powerful agriculture economy. The thing is that we are not ready to acknowledge it. We're not ready to acknowledge because our biases brings it. Although what professor's work has done is giving acknowledgement or even respect to a certain extent to the innovator or holder of the knowledge. But if you look into whether it'll bring about a change in the lives of the people, it won't. It doesn't. And my question is that if it is, if this formal institution's responsibility is only to volunteer their time for the problem of knowledge providers and the food providers, I will include farmers here, only till the point of volunteering their time, why is it not that is their main work? Why is Council for Scientific and Industrial Research, Indian Council of Agriculture Research, and many such institutions or Indian Institute of Management that are there, why their main effort is not to look at where the 70-80% of the population in the world, in the country is working? Why is it not their responsibility? Why it is needs to be a volunteer effort? Why they need to volunteer their time in these things and be charitable about it? Sorry, I don't buy that argument at all. Now, we have been promoting wrong models for a very, very long time. And Tapan mentioned about Gandhiji's and his work. And I suddenly remembered a news item which came in Wall Street Journal recently, which said that the Chinese government is now asking its citizens to go back to villages. It is saying that don't come to the cities, go back, and it is creating programs now to send back repopulated villages. Whereas India has been trying, copying the Chinese and the American model of trying to get people out of villages. And we have seen that just one small pandemic, and I'm saying relatively here, that one small pandemic has sent 80 million people back to their villages. Now that itself creates questions, the very basis of the development model that we are following. Gandhi wrote and J.C. Kumarappa, this is the book which J.C. Kumarappa wrote, Economy of Permanence. And Gandhi enshrined the principle of Gram Swaraj, which was about, which we now call about sustainability, not just from economic, social perspective, but we talked about many perspectives, economic perspective, social, environmental perspective, resource perspective, what goes and what not. And there was an element of market in it as well. Why do we need to, we talk about carbon footprint, we talk about food products moving from one part, 2000 kilometers to the other part of the country. If it can't be grown, if the production can't happen, I agree with it. I have no problem with it, that we should not devoid food or anything, any resource to anybody who doesn't have it. But if it can be grown, why do you disenfranchise farmer by creating policies and systems? Recent so-called market reforms of agriculture is one of the examples where you are trying to disenfranchise farmers by destroying the very institutions which seek to protect them. Now, if you create these institutions which are biased, your formal institutions or formal policies which govern the market systems, like I gave the example during Corona times when our informal economy sustained the country and 1.3 billion people, the formal economy collapsed. And it's a very big example of it, that we don't actually need the state or the formal economy to sustain itself. We don't. The informal economy is pretty much very well organized. It can sustain itself. It doesn't need the state or the policies of the state and in the market of the market that has been created by the state for its own benefit and for the benefit of its own people, what we call as crony capitalism. So I think the issue fundamentally here is that if the farmer is producing something, that doesn't the farmer who has the knowledge, who knows the crop, who knows owns the land, putting his own or her own private capital in it, has the right to decide what to sell, where to sell, and what to expect? Doesn't that come? And how come the policy framework or the system or technology framework or knowledge framework that is available is dividing it? And why a farmer is just glorified as a Annapurna or just as a great innovator alone? They need to have right to livelihood. And that right to livelihood, I am afraid to say, is our very knowledge systems that we claim work for them are denying them. They may acknowledge them like an appeasement thing, but they actually deny those rights fundamentally by the very structure, how they're organized. We don't need volunteer time of scientists and researchers for this economy. We need their full time because we are the ones who are paying for it. So I think the question is that if the so-called formal system of publicly funded formal system, let me not go into the private domain, isn't contributing to the very people who are funding them, and it is contributing to the capital system which is exploiting them, then it is the problem in the mandate of the formal system. It is not the problem of the farmer who doesn't need to understand how this formal system works. They are doing their best. The problem
I don't think that they are doing their best. If you look at Punjab and Haryana, the rotation that they have, paddy wheat rotation, is a completely non-sustainable rotation. Absolutely non-sustainable. In a region where you have low rainfall, you're using groundwater like anything, and you are taking both the crops, which are adventitious root crop, that means they take nutrient from the topsoil of the layer. You need to have a deep-rooted crop in between, like pigeon pea or something, which can take nutrient from the lower layer. It is well known that it is non-sustainable. There are umpteen number of research studies done by agriculture universities, by international research institutions, which show that if you believe that farmers can be kept happy by keep increasing prices rather than reducing cost, and cost can be reduced when people are reminded that, you know, plants don't need water, they need moisture. This is a fundamental fallacy. By keeping power free, you have made people to switch on their pump set, and then they will just sleep. And in the morning, whatever the water has been flooding in the field, the nutrients have been leaching down, and the nitrates have created toxicity in the groundwater, and then it creates all kinds of other problems. Please understand this.
I
will not argue. Wait a minute. Just listen. You have spoken enough. Just listen. You should listen to this, that the argument that we are having today on account of satisfying the farmer's expectation of a non-sustainable land use is wrong. Intellectuals, these market interventionists like you and others must speak the truth to the people. The truth is that what they are doing today is not sustainable. They need to change. And they need to bring in oilseed and pulses in their cropping pattern because soil cannot withstand this. They need to bring some fallowing time in the summer, which will break the cycle of the pest. We earlier used to give them time in the summer. People used to plow the land just to what is called a sunning, because this will help the weed control and will also help maintaining the nutrients and so on. Now we have disrupted those practices. We have disrupted the sustainable practices. We are not using, the carbon percentage is about 0.5. For minimum carbon percentage should be 2% for a soil, for a cultivation system to be sustainable. What are we talking about? This is science. I'm talking about hard science. I will argue on the science basis.
I will argue on science.
I want scientific evidence.
I will argue on science
basis, not rhetoric.
No rhetoric. The exact problem that you've just mentioned is the creation of the science that you're talking about. The problem itself was created by the science. You created a scientific intervention in an area for increasing production because you wanted to meet the calorific need of the population. You created an intervention, you sustained that intervention during using various policies of the government and the various systems. You forced the farmer to change their pattern, invest heavily into system agriculture system. Punjab has the highest number of tractors and agriculture manufacturing instrument in the world per capita. They have the highest number of tractors in the world. They don't need it, but they have two times the tractor they actually need. Now you create systems and policies which move populations and the farmers. Isn't the Punjab Agriculture University or the Indian Council of Agriculture Research or the Department of Agriculture, Government of India, or the Government of Punjab were not aware of all of these things? They were. Yes. Why to put the blame on farmers alone?
No, put the issue now.
Allow me to complete.
I think we should take some. Tapan,
give me two more minutes. Okay. I'll give another example. I'll give you two more examples because what we did in Punjab, we are doing in Chhattisgarh. We are creating a market-based system which is supported by the government, where we are promoting paddy rice cultivation in an area which is essentially a dry land. You are pumping out water, and today Chhattisgarh is called the rice bowl of the country, which keeps promoting because there's a market intervention system you have created, which forces farmer to rely on a crop which is unsustainable by the biological resources of that area. Today's Punjab is going to be tomorrow's Chhattisgarh. The same has been done in Ramnad Plains of Tamil Nadu. Now, the problem I'm saying that passing the blame, what Professor was trying to do, I hope he was not, is that trying to pass the blame on unsustainable practices on the farmers. They are not to be blamed. The science has brought in, the market systems have brought in those unsustainable practices towards them. Now, if you want them to change, if you want them to bring about a change or change their cropping pattern or whatever it is, provide them support to make that change. They will change. I might be sounding negative about the wrong things which have been done. I will give you positive examples also. We have created a poultry revolution in this country. We have created blue revolution. The fish, inland fishery production in India increased. We have created a horticulture revolution in this country, where we were deficient in vegetables and everything. And there's a contribution of Indian scientific community in that. I completely acknowledge that. But that doesn't discount the wrong policies and the wrong science that was passed on to the farmers. Now, passing that wrong science to them is whose liability it is. I think the liability cannot be passed on to the producer. Producer can't be. You need to, when you're creating policies and systems which benefit the producer, you also need to create policies and systems which do not penalize them. It should be both ways. It can't be just one way.
How to summarize this? I mean, one thing that I would say is that I think we all believe in whether it's a formal or informal system, we believe in the power of voluntary action, And I think Honeybee Network itself has been sustained by a lot of voluntary action and people participating of their own accord. So I wanted to reinforce Professor Gupta had mentioned that if there is anyone who's interested in volunteering for this movement, whether it be in a formal or informal capacity, I think the potential to help exists. You know, we need not get stuck into this particular dilemma. You know, but I recognize there's a problem. And I think this is something that people in service-based world have faced over and over again. You know, when, you know, if your basic value system is organized around generosity and sharing and kind of the mutual good, it's difficult, I think, to fit those values within at least what are, you know, formal systems within traditional value frameworks. And so I think very often we are called informal just because we don't align on a values basis. It's not that we're really informal. It's not that we don't have norms. It's not that we don't have structure. It's that they're organized around different kinds of value structures. So I think that much is true for Honeybee Network, it's true for all of our work, it's true for service-based ecosystem, is that whether or not it's formal or not, we organize around different kind of value system. And how to make that value system more interact with the different value system? I think it's a different, difficult question. We will not resolve in the next 7 minutes. It's not possible to resolve. But in the meantime, I think we should take some questions from the audience. So one question has come. Let's see. So here's one good question, I think, for both of you. There is so much to be done, and so little can be done in a limited lifetime. How can a volunteer not burn out? How can service work be regenerative? How can we sustain ourselves and maintain our own health and well-being while working on such big problems? So let me start. Professor Gupta is already commenting on Vijay's weight. So maybe he wants to comment on this one.
Well, I would say that when Vijay joined at one-third of the salary that he would have commanded at that time, actually he was combining both spirit. He was not just a staff, he was also a volunteer. And that proves the point. There are a lot of people who we can't afford to hire. We deserve them, but we cannot desire them. We deserve them. Honeybee Network deserves them, but cannot desire them. Vijay, we still value, we still want you to your time, you know, because there is so much that you know about what we do that your 1 hour will be worth a year of some other person who will take time to understand and so on and so forth. So please don't underestimate the power that people like you can contribute to enriching the dialogue between formal and informal system with all its limitation. I don't argue with you. Your point is valid. That problem was created by the scientific system. True. But we can't bemoan all that which has gone wrong. After all, the way forward is, and you rightly mentioned, by focusing on what is good and how can we leverage it to become better. The question about volunteers not getting burnt out, I think when volunteers do repetitive work and they don't try to invent new questions, new challenges, new pedagogies, new method, that is only the issue of burnout come. I don't think I have a single moment when I can say I'm dull, a dull moment in my life. I have not had one. I don't know what boredom is. I sometimes surprised when people say I'm bored. How can you get bored? Boredom is a sign of lack of interest in life. If you're interested in life, there are enough challenges around you in all fields. So recently, during online education, we are using an online platform. Do you know that this platform will only make us reach those who have smartphones or laptops? 25% people only have a smartphone in India. I'm not able to reach through this platform. My dialogue, my voice is not reaching the 75% people who have feature phone. But Tapan, this is an ICT issue. So let me mention to you that as a volunteer, what did teachers do to overcome this problem? Let me tell you about four teachers who, through their own determination, despite being part of government as a government school, did not remain restricted to the government option of using the online education, because they realized that the children deserved education even if they did not afford a smartphone. So one of them, I think I'm forgetting the name, it will come in a minute. I think Mohan Bhai in Banaskantha, North Gujarat. He talked to a friend who had a studio. He talked to another friend who had cable TV. And normally he would have reached 2,000 children. He reached 20,000 children by using cable TV for communication. And he gave a number of his so that people can talk to him by feature phone and clarify the doubt. He overcame the limitation of smartphone by using cable TV network. Government of India knows, MHRD, Education Ministry knows that a lot of people don't have the feature phone. What are we trying to do? Second teacher, Jadav from Maharashtra, he used the concept of conference calls. Took 10 children on one call, then next 10, then next 10, and overcame the limitation of smartphone because he wanted to reach his children. Isn't it good that you use the available technological tools to overcome exclusion? This is what we want in our society. It will take time for creating an opportunity for everybody in this country to have a smartphone. Yes, someday they should have. But what will they do with fiber optic cable if they don't have a platform to use that network? Third, he used loudspeakers in the village to broadcast the class so children can sit in the veranda and listen to the class and learn. Fourth, he pasted the lessons on the wall. Fifth, he went on a motorbike with a blackboard hanging on his motorbike and held the classes wherever children cluster was. He made school go to the children rather than children coming to the school. All this is happening right now in the COVID-affected online education system, which is excluding large part of our children in the country who do not have access to internet or to the access to the smartphone. So please appreciate, Vijay, that this is a challenge. This is a time when we have to come out with positive solutions for our children who are getting excluded from education today. And mind you, children are children. If they get excluded from class for a long time, they will break the habit of learning every day. They will break the habit of reading every day. Their parents are first generation learners, large number of them. Large number of these children whose parents can't afford smartphone are first generation learners. Their parents are illiterate. They cannot get the substitute for the teacher in most cases. So what did one teacher do? She said, children will sit with one parent on one day. And parents don't have to teach them. They just have to keep an eye on them, that they are not playing around. They are just keep. Now there are different models that have been worked out. And I can go on because we have a huge, you know, Vijay Shirichand has a huge database. Inshodh.org has large database of government school teachers, innovation by government school teachers. We are very concerned about it. Education is a fundamental right. And we know the limitations of the formal system. So what do? We keep on complaining about it? No, we have to find solutions now and here. So my appeal to everybody is, those who are talking about burnout, please, there are enough things to be done. If nothing else, just educate, teach, organize a conference call, start teaching children, please. That will keep you alive, because when you teach children, you get so much energy from their questions that you will never, never get burnt out. So this question, my dear friend, is you have to reinvent the newer challenges, newer purposes, or observe all the exclusion which is going on in our society in different domains and try to overcome whatever little you can. There's no step which is too small to be undertaken. Please don't think that you can't solve the problem of the whole country. Therefore, you should not solve the problem of your own village or your own school. Every small step counts. Every small step counts.
Well, thank you, Professor, for that very inspiring message. And I think I know now how Vijay and I ended up where we did. It's very clear now how we would not take no for an answer. We are coming or we're not coming at all. So thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for that inspiration. Thank you for a lifetime. And for both of you, thank you for joining us today. I think that's the end of the call. And we will... what is the closing, Jignasha, Rohit? Can you tell us what the closing process is?
Thank you. Thank you, Tapan. Thank you, Professor Gupta and Vijay, for such an amazing conversation. Actually, when three compassionate people come together, there are going to be a lot of questions which are going to be raised. And I think that's what's happened today. And I think it's great to have a lot of questions. And also questions where, with lifetime of work, like with Professor Gupta, Vijay and Tapan, like, you know, with so many years of really like being there, out there in the field and still holding tough questions, shows this undeniable spirit of giving, the spirit of service, of really seeing that change happen within and outside. So really thank you for bringing that spirit on this call today. And taking away a lot of messages from here, I think it's largely the spirit that all of you are living. And, you know, that's what I think has come to me. And I guess many more people, like, there are so many comments which are flowing in, questions also. So really thank you for this. And we began with a minute of silence. I think we'll also end with a minute of silence, with the whole intention being that, you know, we don't have answers, but can we hold these questions, and can we, hold the spirit of service, the spirit of volunteerism, the spirit of change, the spirit of really doing good, and see, you know, where our heart voices take us. And I think all of us, as Professor Gupta said, you know, that's one small step, this one little thing, and, you know, the whole web is kind of standing on that. So with that, if you all can go in a minute of silence, and then we'll end the call. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.